From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Today we begin with another conversation on Illinois state government and politics. The General Assembly ended its annual legislative session last month, and Governor J.B. Pritzker has been signing legislation from that into law, including a more than $50 billion budget. Last week we talked about this with the Speaker of the Illinois House, Chris Welch, and today we're talking with his counterpart on the north side of the Capitol building, Senate President Don Harmon. He's a Democrat from Oak Park, and he joins me now. President Harmon, welcome back to the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me back.
And in order to accommodate our schedules, we taped this interview Wednesday afternoon, so we're not taking phone calls live, but you can always let us know what you thought by emailing talk@21stshow.org. All right, President Harmon, what would you say is the General Assembly's most significant work this spring, significant accomplishment, if you want to frame it that way?
Well, we had a very productive session. We made Illinois safer and more welcoming for people seeking reproductive health care or gender-affirming health care. We made Illinois safer not only by banning assault weapons at the beginning of the year, but by giving our Attorney General the power to crack down on deceptive marketing practices by gun manufacturers. And we helped the environment by beginning the elimination of styrofoam, prohibiting the state from purchasing styrofoam going forward.
I understand you and your fellow Senate Democrats invested a lot of time to try and build some areas of consensus with Republicans this spring. Did that actually start with an axe throwing outing in Springfield? Is that true? Did I read that correctly?
It did, somewhat organically. We were looking for opportunities to get together out of the Capitol, off campus, and just socialize, get to know each other as people. And someone came up with the idea of going axe throwing on MacArthur Boulevard in Springfield. And it, we ended up doing it several times in small groups. And I don't give that all the credit for a good working relationship with the Republican caucus this session, but it's certainly disarming when you get to play together a little bit in that context.
Oh, disarming. It's going to come thick now because I was going to say something about axes to grind. Speaking of which, ultimately you ended up not getting any Republican votes on the budget. Why, from your perspective, despite some effort, I understand, and that was thought of to be a possibility, from your perspective, why didn't that come together?
Well, I do want to be clear. We worked with the Republican caucus from the beginning. We involved them in the budget conversations all during the spring session. And frankly, we have a better budget because of it. There's much input from the Republican caucus in our budget. In the end, we weren't able to get the votes on the budget from the Republicans. We weren't able to cross the divide on a couple of non-budgetary related items that they thought were precursors to supporting the budget. But I'm not discouraged. I think it was a process worth undertaking, and we'll do it again next year.
What did you learn about bipartisanship from this spring legislative session? Is that still a worthwhile goal? Because, I mean, you've been in the Senate long enough. You know that that hasn't always been the dominant sort of prevailing attitude among senators.
It validated for me my belief that bipartisanship is almost always better. There are certain issues where we're just never going to see eye to eye, and that's okay. In those cases, we have a strong majority elected by the people of Illinois, and we'll pursue those in a partisan fashion. But on the routine business of governing, we are always better off with a bipartisan coalition. And Brian, you know, 90-95% of what we pass in a typical session is bipartisan or unanimous. But on the tough issues, if we can get good people from both sides of the aisle to sit down eyeball to eyeball and work towards a compromise, we almost always get a better product.
I did mention the passage of a state budget. One aspect of that that's got a lot of attention have been salary increases for lawmakers. And I think it was just last year the base salary for a state legislator was just under $73,000. Now it's more than $89,000. How do you justify that increase to taxpayers?
Well, again, to be clear, that was an increase last year after decades without any statutory increase in the salary. This year, the budget included money to fund the statutory salaries for all officers of the state. No change in that statutory salary. So this was just a routine budget appropriation to satisfy that statutory obligation.
But there was a cost of living increase this year.
Correct.
If you want to frame it that way.
That's built into the statutory salary structure. It avoids the difficult decision of what the salary should be.
Well, over 6 months, that is a 22% increase. Again, I mean, if there are people out there, and look, you may know, I've written about, you know, there may be justifiable reasons to have higher salaries for lawmakers if you want a legislature that has people who are not just real estate agents and bankers and attorneys and people with jobs where they can take time off. But a 22% increase in 6 months, I imagine, will strike some listeners as quite a lot.
I understand the question. It is always a difficult issue. If we never dealt with legislative pay increases, as unpleasant as they are, we would still be being paid several hundred dollars, which, you know, going back to the beginning of the General Assembly. So you have to make those calculations along the way. I think the bigger question is one you alluded to. Should we maintain a part-time legislature, or have we reached the point where we really are a full-time legislature and should be compensated as such?
What do you think the answer to that is?
I think it's a conversation worth having. I have always put great stock in a citizen legislature where people bring their real life expertise to the Capitol, and we pass better legislation because people have those experiences. But I'm also caught by the conflicts that inevitably arise when people are juggling their public service and their private occupations.
So we talked a little bit earlier about the relationship between Democrats and Republicans, but as Illinois has increasingly become a supermajority state, both because of the voting preferences of its citizens and because of clever map making by Democrats, sometimes I think the more important thing to look at is how relations are among Democrats. So how would you characterize your working relationship with both the governor and the House Speaker?
I think the working relationships are excellent. I think our mutual trust level is at an all-time high. The way we passed the budget this year was different than any time in my recollection, where the first chamber, in this case the Senate, passed a budget to the second chamber with an agreement that the House wouldn't amend the budget at all. It required a great deal of trust on both sides, a great deal of working together to make sure everyone agreed on every line. And in the end, it paid dividends.
I got had a little back and forth with the House Speaker on this very point, because he talked about, you know, the idea that the budget was sort of hanging out in public, right? I think it was from Thursday afternoon, was it, until the House voted on it early Saturday morning. So I guess one business day, maybe 2 days, depending on how you want to look at it. There are states, though, where the budget process is much more open and it's out there for public input. Why not actually pass a budget in, you know, over the course of a week or 2 weeks, instead of this still where it's sort of negotiating, and it all kind of comes together? Used to be in a few hours, now it's in maybe a few days. I mean, is that a trend? Are we going to ever see a process where it's just kind of slow and calm and out in the open?
Well, I would argue that's the process we have. And Brian, you've been around Springfield a long time. Every single bill passes the chamber in about 60 seconds when the roll call is called. It's the work that leads up to that. And we began our budget process with the governor's budget address. The House and Senate both had countless appropriation committee hearings where we heard from the state agencies that are funded, as well as all of the stakeholders that wanted to testify. We have a very, very public process. I reject the premise that the budget itself is the budget process itself is the introduction of the final budget and the roll call on the floor. There's so much work, public work, that goes into that. It's easy to criticize the last 60 seconds, but it's not fair to the work that people do over the months of the spring session.
Speaking of the spring session, there were a number of big picture items that people were watching that didn't quite make it over the finish line. One of those had to do with biometric privacy, the Biometric Information Privacy Act. My beloved White Castle restaurant is facing billions of dollars in a judgment. There were some efforts to change that law a little bit. What happened? Why was that not able to come to a conclusion?
I wish I could give you a satisfactory answer. First, Illinois has one of the strongest biometric privacy laws in the country, and we should. We're proud of that. People don't want their biometric information captured and sold. So we have a good structure in place to protect people. Now, that said, in the White Castle decision, the Illinois Supreme Court invited the General Assembly to offer some clarification. And we offered to do so in a way that was very friendly to the business community that has been asking for these changes. For whatever reason, I'm still struggling to understand it, after we offered what we thought was a comprehensive, good faith solution to the problem, the business community not only said no, but they said no in a press conference and basically punched us in the nose without even telling us what the shortcomings they identified were. So we're very willing to continue the conversation, but once bitten, twice shy. That was, I'm still at a loss to understand why they would walk away from such a generous offer to fix the law as the Supreme Court invited us to do.
Another issue that people are keeping a close eye on are the Chicago Bears and whether they might move out of Chicago. There was a news story last week. They're already demolishing Arlington Park. Where are you on that, both, as a general concept and looking at the specific proposals that have been out there?
I'm a Bears fan. I have been all my life. But at the same time, the Bears are a multi-billion dollar enterprise, and they should be free to pursue their business interests as they see fit. That does not mean that there should be a big state subsidy for them to do so.
Should there be any state subsidies for sports teams or government subsidies writ large for sports teams?
I have trouble imagining a subsidy. I recognize that a big infrastructure project may require some infrastructure adaptations in the transportation network, for instance, but I don't see a big government subsidy being necessary for a prosperous and profitable business to keep being profitable and prosperous.
One other issue I wanted to ask you about has to do with public safety, particularly as it relates to Chicagoland, but I mean, this is a problem in downstate communities as well. I guess I want to begin by asking, do you feel safe visiting Chicago, and has that changed at all in recent years?
I feel safe. I've always felt safe. I represent a district that is part suburban, part city, includes a big chunk of the Austin neighborhood on the west side. I've been visiting or driving through Austin since I was driving, and I've been a regular visitor there to community events and political events for 20 plus years. I feel very safe in the community. That doesn't mean that there isn't gun violence, but I think that we need to attack the gun violence without saying the city is a bad and dangerous place. It's not. It's a wonderful, rich, vibrant place. But we need to attack the cause of violence. And that, I think, is a combination of ready access to guns and a lack of economic opportunities.
I mean, this has been an issue for a long time. It's some years it's worse, some years it's better. I know you used to chair the Senate Judiciary Committee that looked at a lot of criminal justice issues. What will it take to really turn the corner on this in Illinois?
Well, I think first of all, we need to get guns off the street. Guns amplify the violence and project it in ways that would have been unfathomable 50 or 60 years ago, in terms of the lethality and the ready availability of military style weapons. Illinois passed an assault weapons ban. We're still surrounded by states that allow the sale of such weapons, and the gun trafficking shows no signs of abating, but we need to attack that problem. I'm also aware that people want to be safe, and they want to be safe now, but they recognize that the root causes of crime are far more deep and nuanced. And really, we need to provide economic opportunities and hope for people who might see criminal enterprises as a quicker way to get out of a bad situation. We need to invest in communities that have been historically disinvested in and create opportunities for young people in particular who don't seem to think they have one right now.
Last thing I want to ask you about has to do with climate change. I went to a public hearing last week for widening Interstate 55 to three lanes in each direction through Springfield. This is just one example of many highway projects that are significant investments around the state. It occurs to me that given that transportation is the biggest source of carbon emissions, why are we continuing to spend so much money on highways instead of, and I know we do spend money on more sustainable forms of transportation, but redirecting more of that money to more sustainable forms of transportation?
I think it's an all of the above strategy to combating climate change. I'm excited that the rail line from Chicago to Springfield picked up 20 miles an hour with the recent track improvements. We need to make sure the track coming back is just as quick. But we also have to tackle the problems as they exist. We are, for better or for worse, a car culture. I'm excited that we're making a real investment in Illinois and being a hub of electric vehicle manufacturing, and excited to continue to pursue that option. We'll need those lanes on the highway, whether they're fossil fuel powered cars or electric vehicles. But I'm excited about what the future brings, and looking forward to making wise and smart investments in a clean transportation future.
Senate President Don Harmon, thank you for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate it.
Coming up after a short break, we'll be talking with the new Miss Illinois about her pageant competition as well as her work in the field of biology. That's coming up after a short break. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.